From the boardroom to the locker room, sport captures the imagination like little else. In this podcast, we talk to the men and women who make the big decisions and those who make the big plays to find out where sport is and, importantly, where it's going. But we do so through the only eyes that matter, those of the fan.
And a very warm welcome aboard the pirate ship at the Reeve Gauche and to the Captain's Table podcast, brought to you by Are You Not Entertained and our great friends at Loch Lomond Whiskies. I'm Giles Morgan. I'm not actually a captain, or indeed a pirate, but a vague ancestor of my family, Captain Henry Morgan, actually was one, and his family all came from Wales as well. For 30 years, I have been lucky enough to travel all over the world as a boring old marketing suit in the sports industry, which included having arguably the best job in the world as head of sponsorship at HSBC. Along that journey, I got to rub shoulders with the good, the bad, and the ugly from the world of sport. And having ditched the pinstripe suit for breeches and the red waistcoat and cutlass that befits a pirate captain, I set out to create this podcast where every fortnight I simply ask my special guests from the world of sport to share their own personal memories of being a sports fan and how that passion has affected and shaped their lives. And ahoy there, my hearties, and welcome back on board my pirate ship, the Reeve Gauche, and for another episode of the Captain's Table. You will, I hope, forgive the radio or pod silence over the last few weeks, but even pirate podcasters need a break. And so after I deposited that lovely Tommy Fleetwood back in Lancashire, I gave the crew a month's shore leave and busied myself with looking after my ship's pets. You are all by now very familiar with my errant feathered friend, John the Parrot. Parrot.
I'm the captain.
But less familiar, I think, with my new dog, Bruce. A glorious fox red Labrador named after the world's greatest rocker, Bruce Springsteen, and a pup who's taken to the high seas like the proverbial duck to water. John and Bruce have made friends with Paul the steward, who is in so much better form, I'm pleased to say. I think it's got something to do with the rest, but maybe more to do with the Loch Lomond whiskey that we have on board. Our good friends at Loch Lomond have once again kindly sent another case of their many products for us to offer our guests. But I think Paul has been helping himself, and he is lurching around even more than usual. Anyway, enough of this guff. It's time to welcome my next guest on board, and I am delighted to welcome one of the stars of sports who sits behind the microphone, Mr. Andrew Cotter. He may not be a name or a face that you recognise, but the rich, velvety Scottish voice that was honed from growing up in the golfing mecca that is Troon, you may well recognise. Is he has been the voice of BBC Sport across the Olympics, athletics, rugby, cricket, tennis, rowing, gosh, all of them, for decades. You name it, Andrew has been calling out the action and bringing it all to armchairs and painting the most amazing picture of what's going on in front of us. He's also a very fine podcaster of golf shows, but in 2020 has found surprising global fame on social media by charting and commentating the exploits of his two dogs, Olive and Mabel. So much interest that he has just published his first book with them. Andrew Cotter, welcome to the Captain's Table. Pull up a chair and make yourself at home.
I've pulled up a chair. I've rolled up a chair. I'm on a chair. I don't know how this chair got onto this this ship, but it's got wheels on it. That's not a thing to have on a ship, is it?
A terrible, terrible decision, because we will be on the high sea shortly. A quick question. A few of my listeners have asked, how are Mabel and Olive? They've become the internet sensation.
First of all, I've got to say Olive is growling at the door because she gets top billing. It's always Olive and Mabel, just through seniority. She's 4 years older, so it's always Olive and Mabel, and they're well. I mean, you know, they're dogs in ongoing lockdown, so they just love it. They love it. We're around all the time. They're as happy as can be. They're getting lots of walks. I mean, the walks are pretty much the same walks every single day, but they don't know. They can't remember it yesterday. So yeah, they're good. They're very well.
And have they sort of got used to fame and autographs and paw prints and all the other things?
Well, the funny thing is that there is a certain level of celebrity for them now. I've been out on walks and a couple of people have heard me shouting Olive or Mabel or whoever it might be has got their nose in something unpleasant. And then the people who are walking past with dogs say, that's not Olive and the Olive and Mabel. And I go, yes, indeed it is. And then I turn my frown upside down because I think they can't think that, hey, that's the guy who owns Olive and Mabel's really, really angry. So I transform before their eyes into, hey, yeah, God, good to see you. Of course, these are the
smiling
dogs.
Owner. Mm. Look, I've been terribly rude. I've got you on the Reeve Gauche here and I haven't offered you a drink and I probably shouldn't. We got lots of rum on board, inevitably, because it's a pirate ship, but it's a bit of a classy ship, and it's also originally a Scottish boat. It was built in Aberdeen, I'm told. So we always take the high road, and therefore our drink of choice and recommendation is Loch Lomond Single Malt Whiskey.
Mm.
And I can offer it to you straight on the rocks, maybe with soda water or as an old-fashioned.
I would probably take it. And again, you know, you say this as a Scot, and other Scottish people go, what's wrong with your tradition? But I would probably take it on the rocks.
Very nice.
Yeah. So
we can. And do you have it peated or unpeated? I know you like the Isles of the Western side
of
Scotland.
I do. So I would. I very much love the Isles of the West. I would have to confess to not being a massive whiskey aficionado. So I know that it's, I do like it. I do like a wee whiskey occasionally, but I wouldn't be able to tell you the difference. And that goes for all alcoholic drinks for me. You know, I could just about discern between red and white wine. So it's not, you know, some of the people that you've had on your podcast, a lot of the golfers and rugby players, they know their drink. You know, because some of them are the older rugby players who aren't in with the modern fads of just drinking isotonic drinks and carb loading and things like that. So they know their wines and they know their spirits. And likewise with the golfers, a lot of them are real wine aficionados. A lot of them own vineyards, for goodness sake.
Well, a lot of them can afford it, I was going to say.
Yeah.
Well, the reason you were actually invited on board, it was partly about Olive and Mabel. And it was partly because I know you're a cheap date because we're slightly low on stock. So honestly, just take that as offensively as it's meant.
To one little finger of whiskey, and that's me. I'm dancing on the table, singing songs about. Actually, you know me. I'm not a massive drinker, and indeed not a massive socialite either. So I'll just sit in the corner.
As is your wont.
Yeah, exactly.
Andrew Cotter, you are the sort of voice of virtually every sport in the United Kingdom, it seems to me, on you commentate for so many things, and it's a genuine pleasure to have you on board the Reeve Gauche because you are your voice is something that goes, it's synonymous with sport these days. But I'm not interested in your career. It's going brilliantly and well done for that. I'm interested in where that love of sport came from and your own fan passion, because what you do is you speak on behalf of all of us fans and you paint pictures for all of us, but you must have obviously your own feelings about sport which move you and have got you into this career. So I just wondered what your earliest sporting memory was as a young boy growing up in Troon.
Well, it would be playing golf. Certainly rugby came a little bit later because they don't let you play rugby as a 2 or 3 year old. I mean, well, they certainly don't encourage it. So but I was golfing at the age of 3 because, you know, there's a children's course at Troon. I mean, there are 6.5, 7 courses in Troon and it's only 15,000 people, smaller then. So a lot of golf. If you don't play golf in Troon, you're considered something of a deviant. So I, at the age of 3, would be out on the golf course hitting the occasional ball with a wee cut-down club. And that would be my first memory, either with my grandfather, my father, my uncle, who are all golfers of varying degrees of ability. But I love golf, and it's an interesting one because golf is not one that a lot of children take to immediately because it's not easy. And you've got to have that almost immediate satisfaction of seeing the ball fly or, you know, kicking a football. You kick a football, it pretty much does what you want it to do. But golf can be an immensely frustrating sort of life. And I say life because it is frustrating throughout your whole life. And that frustration started at, pretty much 3 years old.
And you and I have played golf together. In fact, the first time we met, which was, 15, 16, 17 years ago, you had the misfortune of playing golf with me. And you taught me that it was all right to sort of mutter darkly under my breath when I'd hit yet another bad shot.
I mean, I am a terrible person on a golf course. I mean, I'm a pretty terrible person all around, but I've certainly got a dark side to me, and it comes out on the golf course, because like a lot of golfers, you see, golf is said to reveal your true personality, which I probably shouldn't be admitting that that's my true personality, that I keep bound up and controlled for the rest of the time. But it's just so frustrating. Because you can hit one beautiful golf shot, and then you walk to the ball and hit another shot, and it's awful. And you say, "Why? This is so ridiculous. Why can't I just do exactly as I did 90 seconds ago?" Or you're hitting balls in the range, and it's just a few seconds between shots, and one to the next is entirely different. And that's what that's what good golfers are trying to find, that consistency. But it's so frustrating, the game. But then it reels you back in with that one beautiful shot, and you think all is right with the world. I'm still
waiting for that one beautiful shot at some point. And how about team sports and watching as a fan in Troon or up in Glasgow or wherever it may have been, in terms of your first football match or rugby match or cricket or whatever? Do you remember that?
Football wasn't big in our family. My family, a part of the family from Motherwell. My brother was a Motherwell fan. But no, I was never really a massive football fan. I mean, loved watching Scotland play. And again, growing up, Scotland were pretty good, 78 and 82 and 86 throughout those World Cups and beyond. They never got beyond the group stages, but they were always very competitive. And, you look at some of the players they had in the 70s and 80s, and they were players that would have made it into most teams in the world, whereas things are very, very different now. And so I'm totally disillusioned with the Scottish national team at the moment. But no, never supported a club. And when you're from the west of Scotland, people say, "So what are you, Rangers, Celtic?" I said, "I'm neither. Why do you have to be either anyway?" But that's the west of Scotland for you. But it was rugby was big, and my grandfather played a couple of times for Scotland in the 30s, and throughout the family, it was a big thing. And I played a lot of it at school. But again, as I've said to many people, rugby at school is totally dependent on how quickly you grow and how strong you are as a youngster, because it'll just stand you in much greater stead if you're fully developed as a 12, 13, 14-year-old. Or you might be one of those like I was, like my brothers were, who only did most of their growing from 17 to 22, 23. So, schools rugby is pretty hard if you're not massive.
And was going to Murrayfield, do you remember the first time? When was the first time you went to Murrayfield?
I should remember the first time, but I can't. It would be about 82 or something. But I do remember being at the 1984 Grand Slam match against France, and then walking down Christopher Road afterwards, closed to the cars, and people were just flooding down this street and celebrating this Grand Slam. And I didn't know as a youngster that they didn't come along that often. And then, because 1990 did it again, and there were chances in 95 and 96 to complete Grand Slams, and nearly beat the All Blacks down in New Zealand in 1990 after winning the Grand Slam. I mean, Scotland were very, very good. And again, that helps if you're a youngster getting into a sport, if they're a success, because we're all rather easily won over as youngsters. We want success. That's why, my nephew, when he started supporting football, was a Manchester City fan. And I used to beat him up about it and say, "This is totally unacceptable, because I'm just going for the money and the success." And he said, yes, I am." But rugby was easy to like as a player and as a fan when I was growing up. Although slightly less easy when you were going to play, Glasgow Academy or Kelvin side, who seemed to have many bearded 13-year-olds in their team. And it was just, it was brutal, absolutely brutal. I remember losing 82-0 to Kelvin side. And Mark College, where I went, was a very good school for rugby. But interestingly, at that time, the teacher's strike had just happened in the mid-80s. So people had stopped teaching rugby. It was extracurricular activity. And so rugby fell away entirely. But at the private schools of Glasgow and Edinburgh, it just kept on going. So yeah, we got a few hidings. But I still love playing rugby. I love running with the ball.
What position were you?
Well, I shuffled around. I was sort of a taller, less irritating Austin Healey. I love Austin. But I loved running with the ball. I played fullback and I played outside centre. I was quite quick, but I wasn't very big. So.
And who are your sporting heroes growing up? Who was on the Andrew Costa bedroom wall? Other than maybe Athena poster girls or something I don't know.
Dogs of the 70s and 80s. It was my favourite. So it was The Littlest Hobo. I would say I do remember being a big fan of Andy Irvine. Just a great player, Scotland fullback. For those who don't know, of the 70s and 80s, and getting to work with him, he was the first radio co-commentator that I worked with when I worked for BBC Radio. And then in golf, it was two players really. It was Tom Watson, because he always won the Open in Scotland, and he won it at Troon, and Seve. So. For obvious reasons, because he just made golf seem exciting. And again, to a youngster, sometimes golf might not seem that exciting, but Seve did. You thought, can you look like that and play like that and be a golfer as well? Because even in Troon, even in a hardcore golf town, golf was, you were seen as a little bit uncool if you played golf. So, but Tom Watson, I thought, was great as well. And
were these the individuals as well as I always loved Murrayfield as a little boy coming up as my dad used to come up as a Welshman for the Wales Scotland or Scotland Wales game, and I it was always the North British distillery, the smell of the malt, yeah. And there was just a very very specific atmosphere that was very unique to Murrayfield. And then they were, as you say, in the 80s. And early 90s, they were a hell of a good side. And it was always very exciting. Do you think that the Tom Watson's winning in Scotland, the Scotland team of 84 and 90 Grand Slam sides, these were the catalysts for you deciding on the career that you did?
No. My thoughts on my career didn't come at all till later. All my thoughts were about playing sport. I wasn't interested in you soaked in some of the broadcasting just by watching Bill McLaren or Peter Allis or whoever it might be. On the television, and I watched a lot of golf, but it was all about playing sports. And I would hope that it is that way for most youngsters, until they'll find out in their 40s and 50s that their hips and knees will go. But got to play sport when you're young and just enjoy it. I loved playing golf and I loved playing rugby until getting trampled. But I never had any idea about what I wanted to do and never thought for a moment that it would be sports broadcasting. Let alone commentating on dogs. So I don't. But I didn't know that. I didn't know about sports broadcasting or that I would do that until, even a year after university. I still didn't really know what I wanted to do. So no, that wasn't an aspiration. I wasn't, as you allude to, one of these youngsters who sort of, pretends to commentate as they're playing the sport. I might have over a sort of 5-footer on the practice putting green. Done that thing of this for the Open Championship, but I didn't hear any internal commentary. It was just, oh, I've got to hold this to win the Open.
But I wonder, and I've never asked you, this is even a grown-up question, but Bill McLaren is often sort of called the voice of rugby, and we grew up very much with his amazing commentary and his wonderful Borders voice, that Hoik voice, sort of resonating and booming around BBC. Given that you didn't want to be a commentator when you were a young lad, you wanted to play sport, but now you are one of the leading commentators in the United Kingdom across so many sports, and rugby and golf are obviously what you're particularly synonymous with. Do you ever feel that sense of, I don't know if responsibility is the right word, where maybe some of the magic of rugby for you is a result of Bill's commentary when you watch on telly? Do you feel that sense of the picture that you're painting to the many millions of viewers that you've got a role to help inspire them?
Or
is that too much?
No, it's not. I think responsibility is the right word. And I do feel that whenever when the BBC was doing the whole of the Six Nations, you would be at every big match, and Eddie Butler doing half of them or whatever. Yes, there's no doubt about it. Especially when you go and actually just sit in the commentary position in the same seat, effectively. It probably is actually the same seat that Bill McLaren sat in, and you're effectively watching, the same games, just different personnel that he would watch and commentate on. And that out there are lots of people watching and lots of youngsters out there watching, and not that they're going to take to a sport because of what some silly commentator says, but the fact that they might when they're playing rugby hear a bit of Eddie Butler or Andrew Cotter commentary or Nick Mullins or whoever it might be commentating on it, and they can hear that as they race to the try line. But there's definitely, the word is absolutely right, responsibility. It's you know, you've been lucky enough to be put in this position to be the soundtrack to people's viewing experience of the Six Nations or whatever it might be. That's a tremendous responsibility and honour, and don't mess it up. Don't ruin it for them, first and foremost. So,
and therefore you must get nervous. I mean, presumably you know that you want to get put up. It's a performance. You're putting in a performance every week.
It is a performance. As soon as the microphone goes on, and again, you know, in day-to-day life, I'm slightly more reserved and perhaps a little bit more shy than I am when the microphone goes on, because it is to a certain extent. This sounds strange, because I'm going to also say that it's very important to sound natural, which it is, but it's also a bit of an act, a bit of a persona that you're adopting. It's a sort of an amplified version of yourself. So you're maintaining all the natural instincts that you have and your character, but you're just dialing it up perhaps a little bit more. And I do get nervous. You always get nervous, but I think if you've got the knowledge that you've done the prep and the comfort that you're in a comfortable place. You know, I always ask golfers or other sportsmen, for example, if they're playing in a pro-am golf, you ask a rugby player, take Brian O'Driscoll, for example, do you get nervous in doing that? Of course I get nervous, because this isn't my comfort zone. And you get golfers and put them in a public speaking situation, some of them might get nervous because that's not where they're comfortable. But my comfort zone is in broadcasting, because I know I can do it, and I know I have 20 years and more of experience behind me, and I know I've done the work that week leading up to it. So that gives you the comfort and the confidence, which is mixed in with the nerves. But the nerves are important, because that focuses the mind massively to the task at hand. And so you're razor sharp, the adrenaline's flowing, but you're hopefully, you know, especially in a fast-paced sport like rugby, that you're very, very quick to identify and reasonably quick of thought, because you are so amped up at doing this commentary.
Well, you do a wonderful, wonderful job. And I wonder, I don't know how often you get to stadia or to stadiums just to be a fan, but you did as a young man as well. What is your favourite stadium? That you, not you know, where the gantry is and where your commentary from, just as a fan. Where's your favourite place that you love to go and watch sport?
I'm not sure. Honestly, it's been such a long time since I went anywhere as a fan. And I wouldn't now go as a fan because I do so much sports commentary. Because I did in normal life do so much sports commentary and go to so many stadiums, and it becomes a real busman's holiday. Why would I want to go now as a fan? And it has altered my view of sport slightly, in that, not that I'm jaded by it at all, I'm just stressed that I'm certainly not, I love sport, but that you view it with a more clinical eye, and I don't think you can ever go back to being a total fan. There have been moments, no doubt about it, when I've been watching a game and commentating on it, and you're still feeling the excitement in there of being a fan, like the Ryder Cup at Medina would be one of them. I remember the Masters. I mean, various Masters when it's been coming down the stretch, and you do get right into it. And you know, when it's a big match in the Six Nations, again, I quite often go back to the 2010 Wales against Scotland one in Cardiff, where Scotland were leading by 10 points.
Was that the big extra time, massive extra time match? No.
Well, it wasn't huge extra time, but there was enough for Wales to turn a 10-point deficit into a 7-point victory. Scotland led by 10 points with 4 minutes to go. And again, it takes something very special to lose that. But the point is, the atmosphere in the ground that day was so incredible. And I didn't care that I was Scottish and watching Scotland capitulate and Wales come back. Suddenly, me and Jonathan Davis Jiffy alongside me, that we were both doing a professional job, I would hope, but also being fans, carried along by the atmosphere and the drama of this sport in front of you. And I think to go to talking about which is your favourite sporting venue, I couldn't mention many as a fan because it's been so long, but as a commentator, I think the Millennium Stadium, the Principality Stadium, is very, very, very hard to beat when the match is right. It all depends on what's happening on the pitch.
Of course.
Any stadium can be, Twickenham can be the coldest, most sterile place. Likewise, Murrayfield. But Murrayfield, Scotland playing the All Blacks a couple of autumns ago after Doddy Weir had brought the ball out, and Scotland were, you know, 5-10 metres from a winning try at the end, and the atmosphere then was incredible. Likewise, you know, I've seen incredible atmospheres at Twickenham. Actually, one of my favourite grounds was the old Stadio Flaminio in Rome for character, because it was so Italian. It was a little bit ramshackle. It had a great character. It was bathed in the sunshine, and it was the old stadium from one of the stadiums used in the 1964 Olympics. And it was fantastic. And I think, having them gone to the Stadio Olimpico now, they really have lost something of a character, because the Stadio Olimpico, you know, a long way from the pitch with the athletics track. It is cold and it's sterile, and Italy are invariably losing, and there are 40,000 fans in a 70,000-seater. So yeah, I missed the Stadio Flaminio. Those were good games.
And tell me, I mean, I know you are a professional. This is your job to be a commentator, but you're also an emotional person, and sport brings out emotion. Have you ever been, either as a fan, but maybe more interestingly to listeners, being close to tears, genuine tears, because of something that's gone before you, say the Olympics or whatever it may be, where you've had to really check yourself because of what's going on?
I'd say that I remember the Ryder Cup. Sometimes it's difficult not to get caught up in the emotion that lots of other people are feeling, even though it's not directly your emotion or your feelings, because, you know, it's not your grief. It doesn't belong to you. But when Darren Clark stood in the first tee, or came onto the first tee shortly after his wife Heather had died, and he was playing at K Club in Ireland. And in golf, all of Ireland is united, so it doesn't matter whether he's an Ulsterman or not. You know, he's an Irish golfer. Everyone knew this backstory, and he comes on to play with his friend Lee Westwood against, I'd love to remember, it was definitely Phil Mickelson and somebody else. But Mickelson just, you know, wrapped up Darren Clark in a big hug, and that was the sort of brotherhood and of the sporting occasion. And then he smoked his tee shot down the middle and made a birdie, and the roar and the noise. And then I was doing his match actually in the singles on the final day. He was playing Zach Johnson, and it ended on the 16th, and it had been a horrible day, horrible week of weather. It had been chucking it down, and then just as he was closing out his match against Zach Johnson, just the weakest watery sunshine filtered through the trees onto the scene, and it was still and it was damp and it was autumnal, and it was just, everyone felt the emotion of that moment again. He was dissolving in tears. And again, I'm not in sporting terms a particularly emotional person, and I'm certainly not a spiritual person, but there was something about that moment that couldn't fail to move anybody who was there.
And tell me, but I'm going to try and sort of suspend reality. It hasn't happened yet, but maybe it will one day, is that you and I will go to Murrayfield, we'll be doddery old men. Mm. You won't be commentating anymore, and I won't be dressing up in whatever I used to dress up, sort of branded costumes. And we're going to watch Scotland versus Wales. And at halftime, I generously say to you, Cotter, what would you like to eat? Mm. From one of the vans behind Murrayfield. And you're not worrying about your weight. You're not flogging yourself up Munro's again and doing all that crazy walking you do. So it's guilt-free. What is the Cotter sin food, stadium food of choice?
I'd say, Giles, are you really going to go to one of those vans? Because they are awful. I'm sorry if you're listening to one of them. I don't know. They might be really nice. I have no idea. I'm torn, because I would love just a really good sausage sandwich or a sausage and egg sandwich or whatever. But I've been wanting to move towards a vegetarianism because of my love for animals.
Yeah.
But, and it's a dilemma that many people face, is that, and it's so hypocritical, because I don't care how nice it tastes. Your point is that you should be doing this for the reasons that you believe in. But so I'm a sort of failed vegetarian.
I'm going to give you a pass. I'm going to give you a sausage sandwich with mustard and ketchup, just on this one occasion.
I'd go brown sauce, always with sausage. Okay. Brown sauce, yeah. But thank you for bringing it back. This is cold. Well,
And the great thing is you've got to wait 20 years for this anyway, because we've got a lot of mileage left. We're still young in spirit, at least.
Wow.
Talking of spirit, Loch Lomond whiskies are, as you know, the spirit of the Open Golf Championship, a event that you are becoming synonymous with. And I also know, as you've told us, you're quite a fan of golf. So a few questions. The first question, which I've just been looking at a script, which makes you realise how fucking ridiculous scripts are, because it says, have you ever been to the Open Championship? I don't think I need to ask you that one. And would you like to attend in the future? Well, yes, okay, I think we can just... So tell us why the Open is so special.
I suppose it's memory, and it's a connection with the past and where you grew up. I realise that the Open is attractive to lots of people who didn't grow up near links courses or play links golf. But for me, it is. I can't remember the first one I went to. I think the first one I went to, I thought I had been taken along. This is where memory plays tricks on you, because and how dim and distant it is in the past now, because I thought I had been taken along to the Open at Turnberry in 77 when I was 4, but apparently I wasn't. So I've dreamt that or created it in my head. I don't know. but I do clearly remember, much more clearly remember, every single hour of every single day at Troon in 1982. So I was 9, or just turning 9, during that Open Championship. And I can remember everything about it. And they used to have a wonderful exhibition tent. Now it's far more merchandise now. It's all about the merchandising. But it was a sort of strange old place, the exhibition tent, where lots of independent retailers would sell you these wares, or try to sell you these wares that were bizarre to improve your golf game, or, you know, there were things to do with tourism and golf, or little trinkets or whatever they might be. And it was bizarre, but it was a bizarre and beautiful place to just hang around. And then you'd go out into the sunshine and race down through the rest of the tented village, and then out onto the course and see Nick Price with his moustache leading there. And there's Bobby Clampett. Oh, he's just blown up. And there's Tom Watson, his flat cap, because he's playing in Scotland. And it was the sort of noise, the buzz of the generators, the feel of the warmth and the salt in the air, and the smell of the summer grass and lynx grass. And it is something that you describe that, and you can't quite sense it. But as soon as you do smell, as soon as you do go to these places, you get it. And I mean, that's one of the things I'm really going to miss this summer, is that, you know, and it's all the events, because they all have different characters, and whether it might be Wimbledon and then going straight into the Open Championship and then beyond to the Olympics. But the Open is right at the heart of July, and it's such a key part of the sporting summer, and always has been for me. And so it's very, very strange. Everything's strange at the moment, but it's very, very strange that, you know, we won't be doing it this year.
And as a son of Troon, is Troon your favourite Open venue?
I love Troon as a course, and a lot of people sort of say, oh, it's not that great a course. I say, well, actually, my friend, I think you'll find it is, because they think it's straight out and straight back. It's not that at all. But my favourite venue, I mean, my favourite course now, I was about to say on the Open Rota, it's not on the Open Rota, is the new Ailsa course, revamped Ailsa course at Turnberry. But it's not going to host the Open again with the current situation. I hate the fact that it's owned by that man, but I do recognise that it is a brilliant course. And I would also say that everybody, because I know quite a few people down there, and they all say that, listen, as an employer, the Orange One is a brilliant employer. So whatever else we think about him, and, you know, everyone will have their own opinions on him, but he has, for all the people I know down there. And Turnberry never makes money. It always loses money. And every owner that has ever taken control of Turnberry has lost money and sold it on. It's a difficult place to run, but he's kept everyone in business there at least. So there is that small morsel to be said for him. I just love that place. I love it when you look out to Ailsa Craig, and it's so vast, Ailsa Craig. Whereas from Troon, it's just a bit more distant. And Arran's got 3D. It really looks more alive than it does. It's a silhouette, sort of 2D silhouette from Troon. Whereas from Turnberry, you're looking up Glen Rosa from the, you know, from the ninth tee, which is a brilliant hole now at the Ailsa course. So I'd love to see it go there again, but it gets terrible crowds. So apart from the Trump situation, the RNA doesn't really want it to be there anyway, because it hasn't got the infrastructure or the crowds. But that would be my favourite
place to and start. And if then we're going to give you, I'm going to give you a pro-am team or an am-am team, doesn't matter, of which you are the captain. And we're going to take you around the new Elsa course, which, as you say, is very beautiful. You'll probably find about 28 HSBC golf balls that I left there last time I played. And that's just on the front nine. Who is in your four ball? Well, you and three others. Who would it be? Professionals, friends, family, doesn't matter. Who would you love to play a round of golf with there?
I don't know. Do they have to be golfers? No, they can just be happy.
Anyone, just people to keep you company.
Introduce Bob Dylan to the game of golf. I can't think of a less likely golfer than Bob Dylan, but
well, he'd be very patient. He'd be patient.
I'd like to spend. What I'm saying is, I'd like to spend 5 hours in his company. I say, Bob, you don't have to hit any shots. I'm not going to hit any shots either. In fact, we're just going to walk around and have a chat about the impenetrable, beautiful lyrics.
Okay, so we get Bob Dylan, and he can sort of play or play the occasional shot.
Gonna have to come up with two others here. This is a question that I ask quite a lot of people, you know, in when I'm chatting to them, and then I get cross when they can't come up with, you know, three amazing answers off the top of my head.
Poach your turn, gamekeeper, mate. This is why I'm enjoying this one. I noticed I haven't sprung to mind, which is slightly disappointing, but there we go.
No, but you're hunting. You were in the group, but then you've gone off to hunt for your 28 golf balls. So we've called in someone else to join. I don't know. I really don't know.
Well, should we have Tom Watson because he's your golf hero?
Yes. But, I'm not going to say never meet your heroes. Tom Watson's a nice guy. He's a very nice guy. But, you know, once you've met somebody, they're never quite the idealized perfection that you thought they were when you were younger. So I don't... Yeah, well, actually, no. Do you know what? Of course I'm going to have Tom Watson. How could you not? Because he can talk you through The Jewel in the Sun and maybe talk less about 2009. But just he is Mr. Turnberry, so...
And then why not have Andy Irvine? Good Muirfield member, knows his way around a golf course, got a lovely voice. Because I also think it would be possible to say that to have Bob Dylan, Tom Watson and Andy Irvine as a group has never happened in anybody's imagination ever before.
Do you know what? I was talking during the viral video nonsense of Olive and Mabel. I got into a Twitter chat with Richard Schiff, who played Toby Ziegler in The West Wing, because he, among many other people had retweeted one of these videos. But I had actually played golf with him at a variety club at the London Club down in Kent. I played in a four ball with Richard Schiff, Toby Ziegler from The West Wing, and many other things, Alan Wells and Henry Cooper. And I thought, there's a eclectic four ball. So that was kind of like the addled four ball from the dreams of somebody who was a massive West Wing fan and loved Scottish sprinters and a bit of boxing as well. So I've kind of done that. I've done that in real life.
You have. I like that. Yeah. I like that a lot. And events that you've been to many events because you work at so many of them. Is there an event that is on your bucket list that you've never either commentated or been to that you would just love to go to once?
I, out of sheer ego, you'd like to commentate on a World Cup final in football because you know that the audience that's watching is enormous. But I'm not a football commentator, and I think to commentate on football, you've got to have just an enormous passion for it, which I clearly don't. But in terms of other things, I'd love to, you know, commentating on the athletics at the Olympics or the opening ceremony at the Olympics is. You know, it's a kind of a dream come true. And again, we talk about that responsibility and honor of doing that. I think I would have loved to have commentated on Usain Bolt winning a, you know, Olympic gold. But Steve Cram is one of the best commentators around. I love working with him. He's and actually, that's, you know, we talk about what you enjoy doing about the job. It's kind of the people you work with as well and the trips away. You know, in the athletics team and television, just getting tight, you know, spending time of an evening chatting to Steve Cram and Paula Radcliffe and having fun on those trips. They are, I would say as well, for anyone listening, and this, I can
well,
always
that is a supposition.
Saying,
well, you're assuming a lot with that statement.
No, but I know you've got listeners out there, so hello to both of you. But no, I know this is, but what I would say is that people will suppose that, oh, what a fun job you have. You just turn up and you're traveling the world and you're having a drink in the evening. The Olympics is absolutely brutal to cover because the amount of work you have to do to get ready for it. So when you do, if you do get a chance to unwind at the end of the evening, it's a very quick drink and then you just collapse in your drink of Loch Lomond whiskey at the end of the night because you're so tired. I mean, for example, this, so I'm going off on a slight tangent here, but this, as I speak to you just now, I was about to begin this run of 2 weeks of Wimbledon, then straight to the Open Championship, then off to Tokyo for the Olympics. But you can imagine by the end of that, with the amount of research you have to do and prep on every single player that you're doing at Wimbledon and more than that, and then every single player at the Open Championship, and then every athlete and every country in the opening ceremony coming in. The opening ceremony is just an honour, a privilege, but an absolute nightmare to prep for. And then the rugby sevens as well. And by the end of that, you're just absolutely done. You just want to commentate on a couple of Labradors.
Well, I think we've come to the part of the show now, which I call the Captain's Broadside. And I'm going to ask you a bunch of sort of fairly random questions. The first thing is, you'll notice to your right that there is a beautiful green parrot who I thought was a girl parrot, but in fact, a vet has told me is a boy parrot and is called John, named after the fabulous snooker player. So
91 World Championships. I'm testing my sporting knowledge there. I think it was 91 he won it.
He can't stop. Well, this parrot
massive
has
hair.
Never...
Massive the, hair, John Parrot in his day. Very good Andrew, golfer was, as well.
Very good golfer. Although, Andrew, I will say this parrot has never won the Open Championship of any form. We're free to sail wherever. We've picked you up sort of somewhere off the Cheshire coast, I suppose. And we're free to sail wherever your heart desires. Where can I take you?
Well, you alluded to it earlier, the Western Isles, any of the islands up in Scotland, you know, you can sail up past Jura and Mull and Ireland and Skye. I mean, the climbing on Skye is obviously superb. And then you can sail between Skye and go into the, you know, sail up Lough Hourn and do Larvin and Lunarvane and all the beautiful mountains, Benscreel. But I would say, I don't know how seaworthy this boat is. How far can it go?
Well, it's been to Australia.
Oh, my goodness me.
But I mean, in a sort of metaphorical sense.
Yeah. I would like it to test its ice-breaking capabilities and go to the Arctic and see that before it all sadly disappears. But I'd love to see the Arctic, perhaps even take it down to the Antarctic. And then I would quite like to, could we then nip over to maybe the Canadian Alaskan coast, and I can nip in and try and climb Denali, Mount McKinley, as was. Although that's quite a dangerous mountain, though. So
quite a dangerous trip, and it's a cold trip too. I'm going to have to make sure we've got the appropriate sort of non-fur. I don't know what you call that. A synthetic fur. Yeah. Okay, and you can see this beautiful table that's in front of you made of good English oak that we're going to feed you, although it seems like we're going to be about 6 months. There's a dog.
I just knocked on the table and always thought that was somebody at the door of the ship. So she's quite cross. She thinks that's... Let me see if I can do that again. No, she now is not fooled by it. She's standing right outside the door of this ship. Go on.
You can see it's a beautiful table, all that sort of stuff. What would your... I'm going to offer you a three-course meal. I'll give you cheese, but Well, it's a very long trip, this, but just one night, you choose the menu. What's your three-courser?
Big fish person. Although I love it. I'm quite a simple soul as well when it comes to food. A nice pasta dish as a main course, or a sort of prawn linguine, maybe, I don't know. And I'm also starter. You're doing it again to me. Starter, I'll have Bob Dylan, Tom Watson. I don't know.
Do you want a fish? Do you want a fish soup?
I'll tell you what I like. I like a little bit of... Can we have just a nice sort of tapas dinner? So it's not three courses. It's just various things. So you've got maybe some prawns just in garlic butter with a nice bit of crusty bread as a start, and then you bring out a frittata and some padron peppers, some boccheronis done with a nice sort of...
You're getting into your stride now, aren't you?
Oh, hey? God, yeah. No, I'm actually starting to salivate a little bit. And then, I don't know, I'm a big pudding person, but you can't really go wrong with ice cream. But you know when you're in a restaurant, you ask for ice cream and they give you and they say, oh, three scoops, as if that's being a bit naughty and you're overindulging. No, no, three tubs I would like of your ice cream. I don't. And I,
are
I like
you
it
give
a bit
me a flavour? Any flavours?
I do like, there's one that they do at Wimbledon, actually, which is a Haagen-Dazs one, a strawberries and cream one, which is very good. But anything, not chocolate. I'm not a huge fan of chocolate ice cream. I mean, I'll take it under sufferings, but just vanilla ice cream with some fruit or with some crunchy stuff in it, whatever. But a really good vanilla ice cream, a very good vanilla ice cream. Can't go wrong.
Right. And we've also given you a beautiful ensuite cabin. Which is weird on a pirate ship, but again, yeah. Stretch that imagination. That's what these podcasts are for. What song will you sing in the shower? Do you sing in the shower?
I do occasionally, yeah. I like singing, but I'm very self-conscious about performing, which is strange, again, given the job I do. But but I think that singing is really quite exposing. You know, you're putting yourself in a very vulnerable position, and especially with people watching. I play the guitar and I, you know, like singing, but I'll never do it in front of any people at all. So what songs would let's have a bit of Gimme Shelter by the Stones. Just because I can imagine on a storm-tossed sea,
storm
good. Outside, it's just,
it could be rough. We're going to be, it's a rough passage we've got ahead of us anyway. Mm. Do you remember your first album that you bought? Or LP or whatever they.
I'm not going to name it because it is too embarrassing. That will stay forever.
Is that a secret?
I went through a phase. I'm not ashamed of the phase because I quite like slightly camp electro pop. But for example,
I love the Thompson Twins too.
But like A Little Respect by Erasure would probably be one of my. Discs on a desert island, should that ever arise. So
James Corden had that as well. I was listening to his sister. Yeah, it's a great song.
It's brilliant. Stone Roses, I might have I Am the Resurrection, or This is the One with Stone Roses.
And do you remember your first concert?
My first concert, I was not a big concert goer because I don't particularly like being surrounded by people. So, and I like listening to music on, I like listening to music that they have recorded in the studio. I don't really get the people around me singing, shut up, I'm not here to hear you sing this song. I want to hear them hear the song. You are ruining the song. No, this isn't, I don't go for communal experiences of, oh, everyone's singing along. Aren't we having a great time? No.
So all I must just say to all our listeners, you are getting total insight into the real Andrew Cotter here.
But what I would say is that I went to see the Stones at Hampden, Wembley. So Wembley would have been 93, 90, oh God. But then I went to see Oasis and my ears were ringing for a week. This was at the Irvine Beach Park. So this would have been 94. And we were next to, so Oasis at the time as well, you know, I'd seen the Stones actually just shortly before that. But obviously after 30 years of touring, they were so slick, incredible. And then Oasis were a bit more raw, and it was all about the noise. It was like, I can imagine going to see The Who at the Marquee in the early 60s or mid-60s or whatever. I remember the speakers just being absolutely vast, and I was really close to them, and the crowd just waving forward and then pulling back and falling over and everything. But it was nice to see them in 94 when they were just emerging on the scene.
Well... I've been told by my first mate that we're about to weigh anchor and get on our way up to the Western Isles. So a couple more questions only. Mm. What was your first car?
First car was a Ford Fiesta. I learned to drive in a tiny old Mini, one of the old originals of Isigonis Minis that my uncle owned. I loved learning to drive in that. So I can still smell the leather of the seats. But my first car was a Ford Fiesta A-Reg. And I drove down to...
What colour?
It was red and it was rusting away. But it was a great wee car. And it was written off by somebody in France after I had it for a few years and drove down there for my year abroad in France, and some French guy crashed into the back of me and wrote it off. So thank you for
that.
You
can never forgive them.
No.
And finally, just as we set sail, if we could smuggle, this being a pirate ship and all that, your most treasured possession on board... And we could bury it safely. So probably something that's not living.
I was about to say, it's got to be my dogs now. What are you talking about?
No, and we've got a lovely treasure chest. It's very, very much in our specialty, this. But what would it be? Do you have something that just matters more than anything that we could take and look after safely?
I do not. I realise I'm not playing these games very well today. I do not have a particularly treasure possession. My treasures are entirely my dogs. My other half can probably hear me through the door and is raising her eyebrow at this. But no, I don't think of my dogs as my possessions, but they are a little bit, you know, paid for them.
Well, I'll tell you what, as a special dispensation, they can come on board, can Olive and Mabel, and they can keep us company too.
And you don't bury them in the sand, they just run around and frolic in the sand and in the sea. Can you imagine anything better to have on a desert?
Well, what I might get them to do is to help bury the treasure chest of someone else's treasure.
Yeah,
how about
exactly, and dig something else up.
Absolutely. Andrew, we could go on and often do go on for hours and just talk nonsense, but I am aware that we need to set sail. I've got to be a captain and sort of make sure the crew behaves. So I'm going to let you get unpacked in your cabin. You've been a wonderful guest, and it is such
a
joy.
It's a bit weird. Is it just you and me in this ship? Because it's a bit weird. it's a massive ship, and it's just you and me. I'm slightly concerned now for the 6-month voyage ahead of me.
We'll be fine. Okay. We've got Mabel and Olive as well. But I wanted to thank you very much for coming to the captain's table. And as mentioned, we are a little bit classier, so we're going to leave you with our own special type of treasure, because since you don't want any, and that's a bottle of 12-year-old single malt whiskey from our friends at Loch Lomond Whiskies. Andrew, thank you very much for coming on board.
Thank you very much indeed. Olive and Mabel will have a small tot of that with their evening meal.
Perfect. Well, Andrew Cotter, it's a voice you could just listen to for hours, and what a joy to have on board. And good luck to him with the sales of his new book. For all our listeners, we're so grateful for your support of the show, and we don't want you to leave with your drinks cabinet dry either. And so our kind friends at Loch Lomond Whiskies are once again giving away a bottle of 12-year-old single malt whiskey, which is simply awesome. Particularly, I find the peated version called Inchmoan, which just warms the cockles of your heart. And to be in with a chance of winning this bottle, head over to their Twitter page at Loch Lomond Malts and follow the instructions to enter. Coming up on the next show, we are joined by British tennis royalty, Mr. Tim Henman, a man as synonymous with Wimbledon as strawberries and cream or pints of Pimm's. And I can't wait to have him on board, although he has been a real pain, as sports celebrities sometimes are, and actually asked for a golf net and putting green to be installed in his cabin for the long voyage ahead. I know he's a true golf nut, and I suspect had he plumped for golf rather than tennis when he was a young boy, he might well have made it to world number one, but we will never know. From all my colleagues at Are You Not Entertained and Loch Lomond Whiskies, thank you for the support for the shows we make. We're so grateful for your time. And if you do get a chance, please tell your friends about us and get them to find us on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your pod fix by searching Are You Not Entertained? If you want to follow me or get in touch personally, you can do so on Twitter at GilesMorgan71 or via email at giles@gilesdmorgan.com. So, until we meet again, with the venerable Mr. Tim Henman, please remember to keep your cannonballs dry, your rudder varnished, and your rigging nice and tight. Goodbye.